It's the end of the world as we know it, and I feel fine. That creature starts with an earthquake, birds, snakes, and aeroplanes. Many brutes are not afraid. I have a freaking listen to yourself to the world, but there's no need. Something in your own head, beat it up, and actually got no suit. The ladder from the clatter with the fear of fight down. Night fire in the fire, resistance of the gang, the government for hiring the combat site. But you wasn't coming in a hurry, the security
it down your neck.
Mexican border trap to jump, pay the ground, look at that low plane, fine then. Upfall, overfall, find the next corner, keep letting the loose, leave your devil, save your devil, world, and your own. See your heart, tell me that the river in the river was the right. You patriotic, patriotic, land, might, right, might, feel it, quit
it, like. It's the end of the world as we know it. It's the end of the world as we know it. It's the end of the world as we know it. And I feel fine.
Welcome to the Doom and Bloom Hour with medical preparedness experts Dr. Bones and Nurse Amy, your source for information on how to succeed if everything else fails. And now, your hosts, Dr. Bones and Nurse Amy.
The novelty alternative tonight, decline. It's the end of the world as we know it.
This is the hour of doom.
And bloom.
That's gosh darn right. Hey, friends and neighbors, welcome to the Doom and Bloom Survival Medicine Hour, a lifetime of lifelines in a languishing world. I'm Joel Alden, MD, also known as Dr. Bones of doomandbloom.net, where you'll find over 900, almost 1,000 posts, videos, and podcasts on medical preparedness for any disaster.
And I'm Amy Alton, also known as Nurse Amy. I am an advanced registered nurse practitioner and a certified nurse midwife.
That's right. We are the dynamic duo, the queen and the codger. And we're here to help you keep it together, even if everything else falls apart. Friends and neighbors, have you been injured in an accident with a ravenous Rottweiler? Well, oh boy.
That sounds painful.
Good dog. Down boy. Well, our attorney says, don't call me, call Dr. Bones and Nurse Amy. And listen to this.
All information given and opinions voiced on Dr. Bones and Nurse Amy's Survival Medicine Hour are for entertainment purposes only and do not represent medical advice for anything other than post-apocalyptic settings. No contract or provider-patient relationship exists or is implied between the hosts and listeners. Dr. Bones and Nurse Amy strongly urge their audience to seek modern and standard medical care whenever and wherever it is available.
Ah, but what do you do when the ambulance isn't on the way, maybe even heading in the other direction? What do you do? Well, you know what? You show the world that you're smarter than a box full of dodo birds. That's what, by learning what to do for injuries and illness in good times or bad. And while you're at it, get some supplies, add a medical kit to go along with all that knowledge. And what better place to get it than the lovely Nurse Amy's entire line of often imitated, never equaled medical kits at store.doomandbloom.net. They'll help you handle medical issues in tough times, and they're designed by yours truly, an MD, and hers truly, an advanced registered nurse practitioner.
But mostly by hers truly.
Mostly by hers truly, she says.
That's all right.
Compare our kits for contents, for quality, for cost with anybody else's stuff, or just ask anyone who's ever bought one, and you'll agree our kits are the ones you should have in your medical storage.
Well, I was going to say, speaking of medical kits, we also have medical education. So I just want to mention a couple of classes that we have recently scheduled.
Awesome.
One of them I just scheduled about 15 minutes ago. Is the 8-hour survival medicine class. It is a full day filled with amazing things.
Amazing.
That you're going to learn how to take care of burns.
How to identify pneumonia by listening with a stethoscope.
How to stop a hemorrhaging wound, including hands-on tourniquets, all kinds of tourniquets, Israeli bandages, other pressure dressings, and exactly how to stop bleeding. In fact, we're going to have a little scary, traumatic setting, and everyone's going to have to quickly stop the bleeding.
Ooh.
Yes, so you're going to have to learn what we're teaching you. I also have a full suture and staple class within the 8 hours.
All right, we're going to talk about how to put together a good sick room. We're going to talk about other things, how to deal with mass casualties, how to, of course, how to take blood pressures and, you know, basic things that everybody needs to know, how to listen to the lungs, listen to the heart. And so it's got, it's chock full of information, certainly not just
Did you mention how
opinions.
To put Sam splints on?
Also, how to put Sam splints on.
Yes,
sure.
Demonstration.
Exactly,
of that.
What to do with orthopedic injuries. So lots and lots. And where is it going to be?
Well, we have I have two classes now. One of them is exactly where I just had a class in May. It's in Sevierville, Tennessee, just east of Knoxville off of 41. And that will be at 8:30. Actually, check-in's 8:30. We're going to start at 9. On, again, October 21st. That is a Saturday. And I'm going to put that class up. Probably by the time you guys are listening to this, I will have that up. Go to doomandbloom.net. And then click on the classes tab.
You have another class, too, that's coming up.
Same exact class we're going to do, but that one's going to be in Jacksonville. Excuse me. That's my ginger ale coming up.
Uh-huh.
Jacksonville, Florida.
You're carbonated.
I know. A little carbonated. A little gassy. On December 3rd. And that is a Sunday. And the reason we're doing that class on a Sunday is because the NPS.com, NPS Expo show, I think it's NPSExpo.com, is actually on the 1st and 2nd, which is a Friday and Saturday. So Sunday, we're going to do the full hour survival medicine training. It's a Hampton Inn in Jacksonville, on the southern side of Jacksonville. So if you live anywhere near Jacksonville, you may want to sign up for that class. Again, we don't do it very often, and you know, just if we happen to find the right place and the right time, we do it, but once or twice a year. So
absolutely.
And we have two more classes this year, and we'd love to see all you guys come visit us.
Absolutely. Well, let's see what we've got.
Maybe contact.
That's right.
Someone to get a hold of us.
That's right. What's the deal, Hot Wheels? We learn as much from you guys out there as you do from us, so why not connect with us? It's easy, and here's the lovely Nurse Amy to tell you how.
Why, thank you, sir. We have email, of course. You guys can email us at drbonespodcast@aol.com. You can find us on Facebook at our group Survival Medicine, Dr. Bones and Nurse Amy. Have a couple of Facebook pages, Doom and Bloom and Doctor, spelled out, Dr. Bones and Nurse Amy Show. You can follow us on Twitter at Prepper Show. We have an Instagram. I actually put up an Instagram.
Oh, yay, cool.
Yesterday.
How did people get to our Instagram?
That is Doom and Bloom Medical.
Doom and Bloom Medical.
Doom and Bloom Medical.
And, of course, there's a YouTube channel that we have. It's Dr. Bones Nurse Amy. And all sorts of other stuff. And we have, of course, our other podcasts all about current events, American Survival Radio, broadcasts from a number of radio stations throughout the country, both land and interweb. That's absolutely right. Well, I wanted to talk a little bit about something I read in the Wall Street Journal. You know that the Wall Street Journal says that maybe you no longer have to fast before having surgery.
Oh, seriously?
Yeah, according to a Wall Street Journal article by a physician, an academic physician, says that if you do not eat before having surgery, it's like a 200-pound person burns about 3,000 calories and loses a significant amount of muscle stores, carbohydrates during an operation. And they asked, would you tell an athlete not to eat or drink after midnight before the big race, obviously. And so hospitals in Europe actually are now allowing carbohydrate-rich drinks before surgery with pretty good outcomes. So that, I think,
okay,
is
so
going
liquid.
To be something. Yes.
Okay. Well, I can understand not having the solids because they're, at least when I was in school, we had the risk of aspiration.
Right.
If somebody vomited during surgery, of course, you don't have your reflexes and you have this tube that's keeping your airway open, so you can't shut the airway off and not regurgitate things. It just doesn't work that way. So you can get things into your lungs.
Right. That indeed was the original reason for having people not eat before surgery back in the 1850s when they first instituted that.
And they never got rid
practice.
Of it, but still no solids.
That's
but
right.
I can understand the liquids because your stomach absorbs liquids pretty quickly.
Well, I'll tell you one thing, that if you encourage patients to load up on the right nutrients, like people that are running a race or preparing for a race, it could help to make those procedures a little safer and perhaps easier to recover from. So that, I think, is something new. Right now, I don't think that is the standard, but it is maybe something that might one
imagine?
Day might one day indeed be that way. Well, let's see. Let's talk a little bit about, you know, it's summer.
And oh, boy, do I know it's summer. We're in South Florida.
Right.
I know it's summer.
Absolutely. And, of course, school is out and everybody's taking their family camping. And so I want to, and by the way, what a great way to teach your family survival basics by taking them camping. I mean, you know, the skills that you need to be a successful camper, have a memorable, in a good way, camping trip.
Right. You hope.
Yes, right, right, exactly.
Should we start listing all the things that could go wrong on a camping trip? There's so many.
That's true. Well, the skills to make things go right during a camping trip are similar to the activities that are required for daily survival in times of trouble. And the good news is that once you learn these, pretty much these lessons last a lifetime, like riding a bicycle. And that's why it's so sad that organizations like Boy Scouts and Girl Scouts are in a sort of decline, because there's no greater gift that you can give young people than the ability to be self-reliant.
Wait, did you say that on purpose?
I did.
To get me started?
Oh, yeah.
What was the conversation we had yesterday?
We drove around a park. Yeah, we talked all about that, yeah.
We drove around a park yesterday just for fun, because we like parks and we like to see nature. And we were discussing Boy Scouts and Girl Scouts and how I personally think there should just be Scouts. And that all the skills that the Boy Scouts learn should be taught to the Girl Scouts. And no offense to the Girl Scouts, because I don't even know what they're teaching these days. But I know when I was a Girl Scout, it was all froofy and, I don't know, sissy-fied.
Oh, my gosh.
How to sew, how to be a hostess, I don't know.
All right, well.
That can be, like, extracurricular. But the main skills of what the Boy Scouts learn, girls should be learning the same thing. And I don't necessarily mean that it should be boys and girls together. I don't care if they're separated. But the curriculum that the Girl Scouts are being taught needs to go away, and there just needs to be Scouts. They can have single-sex groups, single-sex camping trips. I don't care. But the same thing that the boys are learning, they need to be teaching the girls.
And what about
exactly the same thing?
And what about people that aren't boys or girls, but are
one of the
14 other sexes?
Then I don't care. Pick
sexes
one.
That there
I don't
are
care.
Now.
Pick a side. There's only two sides at this point.
All
just
right.
Pick one.
All right. Well,
I mean, oh gosh. Of course, that's not politically correct, because I don't know.
You
there might be some neutral.
Again,
thing.
Are you being incorrect politically?
What you know? What I'm saying? I'm saying is that the Boy Scouts have an amazing educational curriculum. And every girl should know exactly what the Boy Scouts are learning. Every single girl. So if they get dropped in the middle of the woods, they know how to find their way out. They know how to make shelter and make fire and find water and make things out of nature.
Right.
Know what's edible, what's not edible.
I totally agree with
you. And how to get yourself out of bad situations. And they teach all kinds of awesome things. And every single girl needs to know that.
Now, of course,
and then they all need to go into 1 year of military service after they graduate high school. But that's for another topic.
Oh, boy. Well, we may have to talk about that on American Survival Radio. Well, I'll tell you what. Let's talk a little bit about poorly planned campouts, which become memorable in a way that you don't want.
Wait, here's especially
one. Especially if somebody gets injured. So we're going to talk about how not to get injured and how to stay safe.
Yes, but before you go, what is the one thing you need to check out before you leave for your trip? The weather.
That's part of what I'm going to talk about. Sure,
excellent.
Absolutely.
Pre-planning.
Yes.
Will save a lot of heartaches.
Absolutely.
Pre-plan not only
headaches and heartaches.
Not only your medical supplies, but what things can possibly happen. And I know you're going to discuss some of those things.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, but the good news is that a few preparations and an evaluation of the limits that your party has, you know, depending on the age of people and you know, their skills, if you can get these right, you'll enjoy a very wonderful outing with people you care about, and maybe you can impart some skills to the next generation that'll serve them well in good times or bad. Now, if you haven't been camping much, don't start by attempting to hike the Donner Trail or the Appalachian Trail or something like that. Begin by taking day trips to national parks or maybe a nearby lake.
Set you know up. What? I really like that advice.
Yes, that is good advice, isn't it? I'm just loaded. I got a million of them. Absolutely. So set up your tent at a campfire. See how it goes when you don't have to necessarily stay in the woods overnight. And once you have that under your belt, start planning your overnight outings. Now, whatever type of camping you do, always assess the capabilities and general health of the people in your party. You got old folks. You got young kids. These people are the ones that are going to determine the limits of your activity. And the more ambitious you are, the more likely you're going to tax the kids and the oldsters that won't be able to handle it. And
exactly.
Guess what happens? Disappointment, a bad time, injuries could be the end result. Now, important first steps to a safe camping trip is knowledge, as Amy says, about the weather and the terrain that you're going to be encountering. Talk with park rangers, consult guidebooks, check out online sources, so many things. And some specific things you need to know, temperature ranges, not just average temperature ranges for a particular area. The amount of rain or snowfall, where the trails are, at campsite facilities, animal issues, plant issues, like poison ivy, things like that, insect issues like mosquitoes, the availability of clean water, that's important, and how to get help
Excellent.
In an emergency. So that's going to be very important.
And that makes sense, because if you're in a really remote area with a lot of mountains, you may just not have a cell phone tower. And so you may consider having a CB or CB. I don't know if anybody remembers those. The truckers know what I'm talking about. A ham radio.
Right, or handy talkie, right?
Exactly.
Or a walkie-talkie.
Or if you have the money, a satellite phone.
Wow, yeah, a satellite phone would be great.
So, but some way to get a hold of the outside world, if you know where you're going, is pretty remote. And a lot of these parks... If you look at the cellular data, like some of these plans like Sprint, when they show you the cellular coverage,
right.
There's full areas that have no cell phone coverage. And it almost looks like right around Yellowstone National Park.
Right. That
so
area.
If you're anywhere in those areas.
A lot of parts of the West.
You may
right.
not have cell phones, so you're going to have to be super careful.
Well, let's talk about some basic things. Of course, a very common error that campers and survivalists make, by the way, is not having the right clothing and equipment for the weather and the terrain. If you haven't planned for the environment you're camping in, you have made the environment your enemy. And believe me, it's a pretty formidable one. Spring and fall may have the most uncertainty with regards to weather and temperature, but you can encounter storms just about any time. Always take enough clothing to allow layering to deal with the unpredictability of the weather. Now, conditions in high elevations, remember, lead to wind chill factors that can cause hypothermia exposure. If the temperature is 50 degrees, but the wind chill factor is 30 degrees, you lose heat from your body as if it were below freezing. Be aware that temperatures at night especially may be surprisingly cold. Watch Naked and Afraid and you'll find that out. Even in tropical areas,
yeah.
It can get pretty darn cold at night. In cold weather, you want your family clothed, of course, and clothed, but clothed in tightly woven water-repellent material.
So wait, so what you're saying is don't go to a nudist colony in Maine
no,
in January.
Probably not a good idea, right?
Okay,
Montana.
You know what? Note to self.
Yes. It's something to keep in mind. So anyhow, water repellent material, that's really good. Of course, some kind of windbreaker. Wool, by the way, holds body heat better than cotton does. Just if you didn't know that, you probably knew that already. Some synthetic materials work very well. Gore-Tex, very popular for skiing, ski clothing, and just add and remove layers as you need it. Now, if you're at the lake front or the seashore in summer, your main problem is going to be heat exhaustion, burns. Make sure your family members wear sunscreen and put on the sunscreen 15 minutes before going out in the sun to allow it to absorb into the skin. Hats, light cotton fabrics, that's important. Plan anything strenuous you're going to do for the mornings when it's cooler. And in any type of weather, make sure everyone stays well hydrated. Dehydration causes more rapid deterioration in physical condition in pretty much any type of stressful circumstance. Make sure that you allow a pint of fluids an hour for anybody that's going to be active. Now, the most important item of clothing is perhaps your shoes. If you got the wrong shoes for the outing, you are going to regret it, buddy. If you're in the woods, high tops that can fit into your pants legs. That's probably the most appropriate thing. If you go with a lighter shoe in hot weather, Vibram soles, those are your best bet. Vibram, V-I-B-R-A-M. The high tops for the woods aren't just because of poison ivy. You know, there are ticks that can cause Lyme disease. As a matter of fact, there's a very high concentration. The population of ticks have grown because of increased deer populations. And so be aware of that. And that's another good reason to be wearing high tops with the pants tucked in. Now, choosing the right clothing isn't just for weather protection. If you have the kids wear bright colors, you'll have an easier time keeping track of their whereabouts. Long sleeves and pants, of course, are also very important. Not only long pants, which I was mentioning before, but long sleeves, it's very good against insect bites that can transmit Lyme disease and other kinds of insect-borne illnesses.
And we know how easily ticks will jump on you.
Absolutely.
Remember, we were just going through that little field?
Yep. When we were in Concord, Massachusetts,
yep.
Going through the Minuteman's Trail,
yep.
We wound
cut through a little field.
Uh-huh.
I mean, the grass, it wasn't grass. It was some sort of, I don't know, what would you call it?
Turf of some sort. It was grass. What do you mean? You don't think it was grass?
It was some sort of weed or some sort of straw.
Well, grass is some sort of weed to me.
Okay.
Just between you and
anyway, it wasn't very high, and usually we think of ticks hanging off of trees, dropping on us. But these things must have jumped on us from that, because all we did was go from the historic building, the little museum, to across the field to the trail.
Right, just a few hundred yards. And
I had, three on me?
Yeah.
One was on my arm,
yep.
One was on my pants leg, and one was on my shoe trying to crawl in.
So it's especially...
Or my boot, I should say.
This summer, especially important to watch out for ticks. Now, a real estate agent's motto is what? Location, location, location. And that's also true when it comes to camping. You always should scout prospective campsites by looking for broken glass, other garbage that can pose a hazard. Sadly, you can't depend on other campers to pick up after themselves, so you never know what you'll find there. You just have to probably check it out beforehand if you live nearby, is what I would do. Of course, look for evidence of animals that are nearby. If you see large droppings that may be related to bears, for example, or if you see a lot of beehives or wasp nests, well, you know you've got some hazards to deal with there. You should always advise the children to stay away from any animals, even the cute little fuzzy bear cubs, because if there are any of those kind of little baby animals around, there's probably a big angry mama that is going to object to your messing with them. If there are berry bushes nearby, by the way, you can bet it's on the menu for bears. Despite this, things that birds and animals can eat aren't always safe for humans, so when you see berry bushes, make sure it's a berry that you can identify. If it's a blackberry, it's a blackberry. If it's a salmonberry, it's a salmonberry, or a blueberry, it's a blueberry. But if it's some weird kind of berry, well, you want to know something? It may not be a plant you should eat. And speaking of plants, your show has learned to identify the plants in your environment that should be avoided. And this especially includes poison ivy, poison oak, poison sumac. Show your kids pictures of the plants so they can steer clear of them. And of course, the old saying is, leaves of three, let it be. And so that usually is a way to identify poison ivy and poison oak. Fels naphtha soap, if you've never heard of that, Fels naphtha soap is one of the early detergents. If you see a magazine.
World
War
II,
some of our old timey magazines that we have here in the old library. It shows Fels naphtha soap chips were the detergent to put in your washing machine.
Or the soap itself.
And it was a golden bar. And guess what? It is still a golden bar. And you'll find it in a number of our medical kits.
And it has the exact same packaging.
Right.
And exact same wrapper.
And
no change whatsoever.
And it's especially effective in removing toxic resin from plants like poison ivy,
absolutely,
poison oak, poison sumac, from skin and also clothes if you suspect exposure. The quicker you clean with the Fels naphtha soap, mm-hmm, the more likely you'll be able to get off the toxic oils. By the way, if you've never heard of Fels naphtha, it's spelled F ELS, and then a hyphen, and naphtha, NAPTHA, soap. Now, you've got to build your fire and establish fire pits if you can, away from dry brush. Remember, in drought conditions, a lot of places are in drought conditions, especially in the west, there's probably 40 or 50 wildfires going on as we speak in parts of the west. And so, you know, in drought conditions, consider using, let's say, a portable stove instead of making a big old fire. Of course, children are fascinated by fires, so watch them closely or you'll be dealing with burn injuries. That's certainly something can happen. Food, to avoid it getting into by animals, you should hang it up in trees away from where animals can get to. Remember, they're drawn to odors, so try to use resealable plastic containers. Now, if you camp near a water source, remember that even the clearest mountain stream may harbor parasites that cause diarrheal disease, dehydration, all sorts of bad things. So water purification is basic to any outdoor outing. There are iodine tablets that serve this purpose, water purification tablets with chlorine, portable filters like the Life Straw or the Mini Sawyer. These are light, take up almost no space or weight in your pack, and they're very, very effective. Although it's a little time consuming, you can boil local water, of course, a good idea if you don't have anything else to avoid trouble. So those are some things that are very important to do to make sure you stay safe and stay healthy. Now, few people can look back to their childhood and not remember a time when they lost their bearings, when they got lost in the mall or got lost on a hike or something like that. You know, your kids should always be aware of landmarks near the camp or on trails. Point them out to them regularly. That is very important. A great skill to teach you, the youngsters, is how to use a compass. Make sure they have one on them at all times. They're not expensive, or at least you can find expensive compasses, but you know, most of them aren't that expensive.
Which is another reason they should do the Boy Scouts.
Yes, an excellent reason to do
You know, you can get Girl Scouts, probably girls into Boy Scouts now, just say they identify as a boy.
There you go. Yep.
What are they going to do, say no?
Yep. I identify as a...
I mean, not that the girl does, but just so she can learn the skills.
Well, I identify as a goat. An old goat. By the way, you know what's a great item to give every kid, and maybe every adult, is a whistle. Some loud whistle they can blow if you get separated from them and you're concerned. You know, three blasts of a whistle, that's the universal signal for help. Tweet, tweet, tweet. And I don't mean on your cell phone. I'm talking with the whistle.
That's funny.
And, you know, if lost kids, by the way, stay put in a secure spot. Don't roam around because, you know, you're a moving target and it's going to be harder to find you if you do. Of course, if you have cell phone service where you are, that's awesome. Keep your cell phone around with you, as a matter of fact. Bugs, again, even kids in protective clothing many times will wind up with insect bites. Important supplies to carry are antihistamines like Benadryl, sting relief pads, we have those in our kits, calamine lotion to deal with allergic reactions, and of course, asking your doctor for a prescription for an EpiPen is a very good idea, as they're meant to be used by the average person. Doesn't take a doctor to use them, and they're very effective for severe reactions to toxins caused by bee stings or poison ivy or pretty much just about anything. And we've talked about these kind of allergic reactions, which are also called anaphylaxis, many times in past shows, and you'll find it all over the website at doomandbloom.net. Citronella-based products, those are very helpful to repel insects. Put it on clothing, though, instead of skin. It seems to absorb too easily whenever possible. It lasts longer on clothing. You might not know that.
Absolutely. Now, so another thing you might consider is the lemon eucalyptus oil. And that one is FDA approved.
That's right, and EPA approved. And repellents using DEET can also be used, except on children that are less than two. And you probably should.
Good point.
Always make sure that those kids are well dressed, so they can avoid bites. Now, don't forget to inspect daily for ticks or the bullseye pattern rash that you sometimes see in Lyme disease. And I mean it when I say daily. If you remove the tick in the first 24 hours or so, it rarely passes the Lyme disease onto you. So that's important. It's those ticks that stay on for 36 hours, 48 hours, that wind up causing Lyme disease. And so That's why a daily inspection to make sure there are no ticks, maybe a shower, if you have the ability to have a shower, that would be awesome. So let's talk a little bit about what I think you should have in your first aid kit. And so, of course, insect repellents make sense, a way to sterilize water. These are things that we've talked about already. But besides that, you're going to want to carry specific things like antiseptics to clean wounds, iodine pads, alcohol pads. Those are very useful. BZK, benzalkonium chloride. That's also very good. BZK. Bandages, of course, of various types and sizes, roller gauze, roller ABD pads, moleskin, second skin, ace wraps, butterfly closures. Those are all very useful. Cold packs, the kinds of shake and break kinds, so you can shake them or crack them and they
get
cold. Right, crack them. And they
reduce swelling. You actually fold them in half and then pop them.
Right, and it reduces swelling. So that's a really good thing to have. Splints, of course, so you have splints that are very compact nowadays but are 36 inches long. One of the things that we teach in our class is how to place them in different areas of the body so that they help immobilize injuries, so that's important. Burn gel, non-stick dressings like Telfa pads, T-E-L-F-A. These pads will not stick to burns, which are very painful to remove normal, regular gauze pads, so that's important. You might want to have a thermometer. You might want to have some gloves. Some people are allergic to latex, so try to get the nitrile gloves, N-I-T-R-I-L-E. Triangular bandages with safety pins to serve as a sling. You can use a bandana, a long bandana, as an alternative there. Bandage scissors or EMT shears so you can get through clothing and see what a bad injury might look like. Tweezers to help remove splinters and ticks. Maybe an antibiotic cream. An oral antihistamine like Benadryl might be a good thing to have. Of course, we mentioned already an EpiPen. Tylenol, Advil, aspirin, all these are good pain medicines, also useful for fevers. Some steroidal cream, over-the-counter stuff like 1% hydrocortisone cream, that's good to decrease inflammation, and so on. I'm sure you have some other ideas of what you would want in your kit, but I think that's a good start.
You know what? You have a very good list.
Good start.
A good start, absolutely. Did you mention some sting relief?
Sting relief pads. We mentioned them earlier, and so it's something that would be a good idea.
Yeah, I'm just thinking a lot of bug bites.
Yeah.
So, yes, at indeed. Least from what we went camping down here in Florida.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, well, boy.
And so, you know, there are probably special issues that some members of your families may have, especially those with chronic medical problems. Mm-hmm. But, you know, make sure that you have the items that we just talked about. Add more, customize the kit so that it makes sense for you and your family. And all these items that I mentioned are really good components of a survival medics kit as well. So in an emergency, the most important thing to do, stay calm. You're going to be armed with it. If you have this kit that I mentioned, then you'll find we have these kits on our website, but you can make them yourself. I completely encourage you to do that. At least you'll be armed with the materials that would make sense for these kinds of outings. Remember to act quickly and wash wounds thoroughly, have a plan of action, and you will be educated. And your own education, that is as important as your kids. Don't fail to take a first aid course so you have the knowledge needed to deal with medical issues on the trail. If you do this, you have the best chance to have a happy and safe camping trip with your family this summer. Now let's talk a little bit about some things you might find on the trail. Of course, in the summer, warm weather, you're going to find yourself outdoors a lot, activities, and in a survival situation, you would also, as well as you can imagine, with activities like gathering wood for fuel, foraging, hunting, all that stuff required to keep body and soul together. And in warm weather, you might find yourself face to face, or maybe face to ankle, with a snake. Yep, snakes. They are all over the place. There's very few places that do not have snakes, and they are mostly out in warm weather. Most snakes aren't poisonous, but a few are, including some species that are common to North America. And I must say that the term poisonous snake is probably incorrect, because a venom, which is what a snake has, and poison is not, these are not the same thing. Poisons are absorbed in the gut from eating it or ingesting it, or through the skin, which can be absorbed through the skin. But venom has to be actually injected into tissues or blood via fangs of, let's say, a poisonous snake or a venomous snake, or a stinger from a bee or a wasp. And interestingly enough, it's usually not dangerous to drink snake venom unless you happen to have a cut or a sore in your mouth. So can't say the same thing about poison, arsenic, and things like that. But having said that, please don't try this out at home. Do not try to drink snake venom. It is, interestingly enough, probably not going to kill you, but probably not a great idea either. Venomous snake bites have a pretty distinct appearance. They have these hollow fangs, big teeth basically, at the front of the mouth. There's one on each side of the jaw. And this differs from non-venomous snakes. Their teeth has a more uniform appearance. The venomous snakes have the big fangs in the front and maybe some smaller teeth in back. And non-venomous snakes have teeth that are about the same size all the way around. And I wrote an article about this at doomandbloom.net, and I actually put a picture up of what a venomous snake bite looks like. And there's also a photo of a venomous snake bite, and also what a non-venomous snake bite looks like. Now, snakes are most active during the summer, as I mentioned, so you're going to find most bite injuries occurring then. But not every bite from a venomous snake transmits toxins to the victim. You may be surprised to find that 25 to 30% of these bites are going to be dry and show little or no effect. And that could be, it's hard to say why that is. It could be because of the short duration of time the snake has its fangs in its victim, or whether maybe the snake had bitten another animal shortly beforehand and in an act of predation. And many other snake bites, there are snake bites that are dry, they have no venom, and there are most other snake bites are also what they call slight envenomations. In other words, only a small amount of venom goes in and they resolve without any major intervention. Now, in most cases, it's not hard to tell whether there's venom in the bite. Usually snake bites containing venom tend to cause a painful burning sensation pretty much almost immediately, and swelling at the site may begin as soon as maybe 5 minutes afterwards and can start traveling up the affected area to the body core. Now, the two types of snakes to worry about in North America, at least, are the pit vipers and the elapids. In Europe, you'll have adders, also A-D-D-E-R-S. Of the two in North America, the one that's most responsible for the grand majority of venomous bites are pit vipers. Pit vipers are like rattlesnakes, water moccasins, those kinds of critters, and they're identified by the presence of a heat-seeking pit organ between the eye and the nostril on both sides of the head. That's why they call them pit vipers, and probably more easily recognizable by a triangular shaped head and slit-like eyes. Now, rattlesnakes, of course, are going to have rattles, right? That makes sense. So those rattles will make noise when they're threatened.
That must be a very ominous sound. I think maybe I heard one or two when I was a kid. Or maybe I imagined it. Are they in Georgia?
Yes. Uh-oh. There are lots. There's southern
I seem to remember a couple rattlesnake sounds.
Oh, yeah.
We owned 4 acres when I was growing up.
There are more rattlesnakes in North America than there are pretty much anywhere else in the world. And you can't say the same thing about the other ones. We'll talk about those in a second. I don't want to forget to say this about the pit viper bites. Pit viper bites have a tendency to look bruised and blistery at the site of the wound, and you may notice numbness after some initial pain. You may notice some numbness
pretty quickly.
Right, and this will occur within a few minutes. You might feel some weird sensations on your lips, for example, or on your face. Some people describe a metallic or rubbery taste in their mouth. And serious bites, though, from these guys, if you have a serious, what they call envenomation, that may cause actual spontaneous bleeding from the nose or the gums, irregular heart rhythms, difficulty breathing. So it can really, if you get a lot of venom in you, then you could be in pretty big trouble.
Sounds awful.
Now, those are the pit vipers. The other type is called the elapid. The elapids include cobras and mambas and all sorts of snakes that we don't have here.
I just hate all snakes. I'm sorry. I don't care if they're friendly, if they're snuggly. Well, I don't know. I know a lot of people own snakes.
Yeah, well,
just creep me out. Now, have you ever looked at a snake and said, oh, you're so cute?
Yeah.
Ever.
Little baby snakes.
Oh, yeah, that's true. We have little grass snakes.
Yeah.
Well, that's true. And we do save those.
Yes.
We don't hurt them.
Yeah, I don't.
If they're trapped in our patio, we make sure we get them out.
I don't kill any of the snakes. So we have some water moccasins in the lake.
The only thing I'm actively kill is two things: mosquitoes and those bufu frog tadpoles.
Yes.
Or the adult
cane
frog.
Toads.
The nasty, the one that killed our dog.
Right. We had
our boy and our girl.
Yeah.
Corgis killed the boy.
Yeah, that's true. They when a dog bites a cane
that
toad.
Was sad.
What happens is that it has a whitish secretion that comes from some organs on its, what looks like a shoulder, I guess, and it causes a major effect on the cardiovascular system of a frog. I mean of a dog,
yes.
Rather, because of the frog or the cane toad that is really, really dangerous. And
that's a poison,
right.
Not a venom.
That's right. Exactly. Exactly right.
Because it's ingested and not injected.
Exactly. There you go. Very good. Well, before...
That's a good example.
Moving on, right? I just want to talk about the other type of venomous snake, and that's the elapids. I mentioned that they include cobras and mambas, but they also include the colorful coral snake. Coral snakes appear very similar to their look-alike. The coral snake is venomous. The non-venomous version is a king snake. And both of these types of snakes have red, yellow, and black bands and are commonly confused with each other. The old saying goes, red touches yellow, kill a fellow. Red touches black, venom it lacks. That, in other words, if the red band is next to the yellow band on the skin of the snake, it's a deadly venomous coral snake. If the red band on the snake touches the black band, it's a non-venomous king snake. And so it's important to know that this old saying applies to coral snakes, but only to coral snakes in North America. Coral snake bites are a little different. They don't cause as much bruising, but they are what they call neurotoxic, and they cause mental and nerve issues such as twitching, confusion, slurred speech. Nerve damage may cause difficulty with swallowing and breathing. Sometimes it causes complete paralysis. Could be very life-threatening. Luckily, there were, in the year 2013, only 73 coral snake bites reported in the U.S. Most
Thank goodness.
Of the snake bites are going to be from either non-venomous snakes or from pit vipers, which are certainly plenty dangerous enough. An ounce of prevention, they say, is worth a pound of cure. I fully agree with that. High top boots and long pants, as I mentioned, for camping, always a sound strategy when hiking in the wilderness. It's important to be aware of where you're putting your hands and feet, so be especially careful around areas where snakes might like to hide. They like to hide in hollow logs, under rocks, old shelters. I remember seeing one in a shelter along the Appalachian Trail once. Wearing sturdy work gloves would be a wise precaution if you can't avoid these places. Now, if you let snakes know that you're nearby, they tend to leave the area. Most of them aren't that brave. And you might.
So snakes are really
chickens.
Be
that, well, you shouldn't be.
Saying?
You shouldn't be that brave either.
So
I don't
you're saying
think.
Snakes are really chickens.
Snake
in a snake skin.
The famous chicken snake. Yes, absolutely. A very rare and beautiful
no,
snake.
No, I do want to say something for those who do collect snakes. They're not cuddly, but I guess some of them have beautiful colors. I don't like their faces. But
well, they
just
like
the
to
colors.
Well, you had a bearded dragon once. You liked having that just sort of laying on you. And so that's what snakes essentially
yeah.
do, right?
Yeah, that's true. But he didn't slither.
He didn't slither. No,
he walked.
He did not.
It was a little differently. A little different.
So anyhow, wear work gloves. Good idea if you're going to be poking around these places like hollow logs and old shelters, things like that. If you let snakes know that you're nearby, they usually hit the road. Snakes don't have an outer ear, so yelling doesn't make much sense. But treading heavily, you know, pounding on the dirt as you walk and not tiptoeing around may create ground vibrations that they actually hear, quote unquote, I guess, better than you're talking. Now, in warm weather, snakes like to be active at night also. That means that any nocturnal outdoor activities you might have, they're inadvisable without a good light source. So if you're the Blair Witch Project people, you probably should have a good light source while you're walking around in the woods at night. Now, the standard treatment for a venomous snake bite is something called antivenin or antivenom. Both are actually correct. Antivenin is a animal or human serum or a component of blood that has antibodies which are capable of neutralizing a specific biological toxin, in this case snake venom. Now, most hospitals will have it, but in survival scenarios, obviously this is going to be a pretty scarce commodity. If there's no help coming, then you might consider these steps. One, you should keep the victim calm. Stress increases blood flow, thereby endangering the victim. That's something that's very important. Keep him as calm as possible. Keep him as still as possible also is a pretty good idea. Stop all movement of the injured extremity if they were bitten on the leg, for example, because movement transports the venom into the circulation faster. You want to clean the wound thoroughly to remove any venom that's not deep in the wound. Remove rings and bracelets from affected extremities because there's probably going to be swelling and it might be harder to get off later. You want to position the extremity below the level of the heart. This theoretically slows the transport of venom. You want to wrap the area. Some people don't say not to. Some people do. If you do, wrap with clean, loose bandages like an ACE wrap and go further up the limb than you normally would for a sprain. Now, pressure bandaging is thought to be helpful for coral snake bites, but maybe risky for pit viper bites because it can cause tissue damage at the site of the bite. In any case, keep the wrapping less tight than when you're dressing a sprained ankle. If it's too tight, the patient's going to be uncomfortable, is going to reflexively move the limb. That's going to spread the venom around. Tourniquets, no good, do a lot more harm than good, so avoid tourniquets in these cases. You might get a pen and draw, or a Sharpie, and draw a circle around the affected area. That's important. As time progresses, you're going to see the area shrink if it improves, or you're going to see it grow, the area that's red and swollen, grow, or bruised or blistered, grow if it worsens. This is, by the way, a good strategy to follow for just about any local reaction or infection or abscess or accumulation of blood under the skin, like a hematoma. So this is, a Sharpie is indeed a medical supply. So don't be afraid to keep a few of them in your backpack. That's a wise move. The limb should then be rested. Maybe you should immobilize it with a splint or a sling so people don't move it. Less movement there is, the better. You keep that person on bed rest with the bite site lower than the heart for about 24 to 48 hours. And by the way, this strategy also works for bites from venomous lizards like Gila monsters if you're in the desert in the Southwest. So that is something that is a pretty good thing. Of course, in normal times, definitely take that person to the hospital if you can. Now, you may have heard that it's appropriate to make a cut in the area of the bite and try to suck out the venom with your mouth. Probably not a good idea. The amount of venom you remove is very little, and the bacteria in your mouth is probably going to introduce an infection, not something that you're going to want to do. There are snake bite kits that are available for your backpack, but these are out of favor with most wilderness medical professionals. There's something called the Sawyer extractor, which is a suction cup, essentially, or a syringe with a suction cup tip, so to speak, and it may work to remove some of the venom, but believe it or not, at the present time, it's considered to be not effective enough to eliminate more than just a fraction. So these methods fail mostly due to the speed at which the venom is absorbed in the body. And you may wonder why I haven't suggested antibiotics. I talk about antibiotics a lot, but I haven't mentioned it as a treatment for snake bite. And interestingly enough, snake bites don't cause infections as frequently as bites from cats, dogs, or humans. As such, antibiotics are used much less often in these circumstances. So some parting thoughts on snake bite. A snake, by the way, doesn't always slither away after it bites you. It's likely that it still has some more venom than it can inject. So if I were you, I would move out of its territory or abolish the threat in any way you can. Now, of course, to many people, this means that you should kill the snake, but I have to warn you that killing the snake may not be enough. I mean, even cutting the head from the body doesn't always render it harmless. It can reflexively bite for a period of time, and it still has some venom in those fangs. Now, coral snakes and pit vipers, they may respond differently to an encounter with a human. Coral snakes are not as aggressive as pit vipers. They would rather flee than attack. But once they bite you, they have a tendency to hold on in order to inject more venom. So that's something that's important for you to know, that it may be hard. You may actually have to pry this snake off you. Now, rattlesnakes, however, and other pit vipers prefer to bite and then let go quickly. But unlike coral snakes and other elapids, pit vipers may be very reluctant to relinquish their territory to you. So it's important to leave the area as soon as you possibly can. Now, snakes, remember, can be dangerous, but they really want to avoid you as much as you want to avoid them, believe me. So keep an eye out, wear decent gear, and both you and the snake are going to be much, much happier for it. I guarantee it. Well, we are almost out of time, but I think we haven't really mentioned where we're going to be besides those 2 8-hour classes.
Yeah.
But we are going to be before
yes.
either of those classes. We are going to be in a number of areas. So why don't you tell us where we're
going? Yeah, we actually have a pretty busy late summer and fall time. Yeah. All right. So our next travels, we'll call it, is to something we haven't done before. It's called the Ultimate Outdoor Expo. Wow. Sounds like lots of fun. It's going to be in Lexington, Kentucky.
Awesome.
Yep. We're going to drive up there. And that's actually a 3-day event. And that's something we don't usually do. That starts on Friday, the 25th of August. It goes through the 26th and also Sunday, the 27th. And we're going to actually be speaking on Saturday and Sunday. You're going to speak one day, I think, on survival medicine, and I'm going to do one on survival supplies,
awesome.
Medical supplies.
These are completely free lectures, right?
Absolutely, okay. Absolutely.
All yep, right, and where are we going to be next?
Then we're going to be, hopefully, at the RK Prepper Show in Chattanooga, Tennessee, on September 2nd, and September 9th is the Knoxville, Tennessee RK Prepper Show, and then we'll be driving home quickly, because 2 weekends from there, on September 22nd and 23rd, we're actually going to be in Denver, Colorado. Beautiful Denver, gorgeous weather. At the SRE show.
Self-Reliance Expo.
Self-Reliance Expo.
All right, we've done that
right.
for many years. Okay,
yeah.
Sounds good. All right, so there are just
a few
places that we're going to be going to. And we thank you so much for listening to the Survival Medicine Hour with Joe and Amy Alton, also known as Dr. Bones and Nurse Amy. Thank you so much, and I hope you will listen in next week.
Just quickly mention, we're also going to do a suture class in Denver. That's
okay.
going to be Friday from
All right.
one. Yes.
Sounds good. Learn some skills. All right, guys. Thanks so much. We'll see you next time.
Thanks.
You've been listening to the Doom and Bloom Hour with medical preparedness experts Dr. Bones and Nurse Amy. Check out our website at www.doomandbloom.net for hundreds of informative articles about survival medicine, gardening, natural remedies, medical supplies, and lots of other good stuff. Contact us, send your email to drbonespodcast@aol.com or use the contact form on the main page of the website. See you next week.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather, now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
VGW Group, no purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions, 18 plus.